it reinforces this dent of your confidence. You've got this little ball of confidence. And every time you don't respect yourself or you lower one of your boundaries, it takes a little tiny chip out of it. Now, what I always often say to my clients, if that happens once in your life, it's not going to really do any damage. It's almost akin to your diet. You have one McDonald's, you don't become unhealthy. But if you live on McDonald's, you're not going to be healthy. And it's the same with lowering your boundaries. If every time you're faced with a time when you've got to be firm on your boundaries and you don't, the impact on you is that you're basically saying, I'm not worth standing up for. My boundaries don't matter. What other people think is more important than what I think.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today I talked to Angie McQuillan, a speaker and coach that works with leaders to build their confidence to better connect with their teams. Angie shares intimate stories of abusive relationships from her past and how setting boundaries helped her break toxic patterns and rediscover her self-worth. She is a unique mix of kindness, vulnerability, and 100% pure badassery. Angie talks about how we slowly lose our self-worth every time we put someone else's needs above our own. It's not about being selfish. It's about being clear and unapologetic about the things we will accept and the things we won't. If you ever suffer from imposter syndrome, people-pleasing, avoiding conflict, dysfunctional relationships, or burnout, this conversation is for you. And yeah, me too. Angie also gives me a crash course in roller derby, a sport that seems like a sadistic mix of hockey and Quidditch from Harry Potter, just a whole lot more violent. She also shares inspiring stories of her nomadic life living in her van and the heartbreaking loss of her dog Louie this year. This is one of my all-time favorite conversations. Please enjoy Angie McQuillan. Welcome, Angie, to the podcast. Wow, it feels like we've been trying to make this happen for so long. I'm excited about this.
I know, it's been a while, isn't it? Since the last time you reached out to me, I think it's been at least 4 months or something. So yeah, glad to be here.
I was actually thinking about what compelled me about your content. And of course, you're incredibly vulnerable and personal. You've got great stories. You have really great insights on confidence and the stuff you do for a living. But honestly, I think it was a post, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago, about roller derby. And so I just have to ask you about this because until I saw your post, I'm like, I didn't even know this was a thing. Maybe I thought it was outlawed or something. Tell me about roller derby.
Sure. Well, the only reason why I'm not in the UK at the moment is because I have this lovely cast in my hand from a broken thumb. So roller derby is basically a full body contact game on roller skates. So it's easy to kind of compare to ice hockey, but you don't have a puck and you don't have the stick and you're not just skating anywhere. You're on an oval track. So unfortunately, for my own sins, the role that I take in the team is called the jammer, which is the point scorer, which means that every time I'm on track, I've got at least three and normally four people on the opposing team trying to knock the crap out of me. So it's quite high injury, should we say, but it's a lot of fun.
So you're carrying a ball?
No ball, no ball, no sticks. Basically, I become the ball effectively. Oh. So the way that just to give you a quick overview then. So you've on every, it's called a jam, which runs up to 2 minutes and the whole game is an hour, but you've got lots of mini jams in the middle. And then basically every jam that you go on, every time you go on track is considered a jam. And my role is to get through what's called the pack, which is my team and their team. Their team are trying to stop me from getting past. My team are trying to stop their jammer from getting past. And then as soon as you get out of the pack, which is the cluster of people, you become the lead jammer for that particular jam, which means you control the jam. And then the aim is to get around as many times after that. And every person that you get past of the opposing team, you get a point. So so if you get around, say, four times, you're going to rock up, 12 points or whatever. So it's really useful to know you can keep tracking how many points you rack in. So as soon as they start getting points, you just call it off, which is when you bang on your hips, then the whistle is blown from the referee, and then you go into the next jam. So that's how you rack up points against your opponents.
I swear you just described a game from another planet that I've never heard of. I know nothing about.
Check it out on YouTube. It's good.
Oh, I can see myself going down a rabbit hole of content on roller derby. What do you love so much about it?
I think it's just, first of all, you've got to be so present in it. It's so fast. There's a lot of skill involved. It's high energy. If you're not falling carefully or you're not paying attention to your team, you end up just getting smashed, basically. So you're constantly having to be really present. So anything else that's going on outside your life just doesn't even get a look in. Because if you take your eye off the ball, even though there's no ball, but you know what I mean? You take the eye off the moment, you get smashed by the opponents. I like high contact games. I've always been into physical contact. So I played football for 25 years and then obviously got into roller derby as well. So I've always played like the games with a bit of oomph. And it's just really exciting, loads of fun. And it's a women dominated game at the moment as well, which that's extra unusual as well.
How many bones have you broken?
Oh, crikey, I've lost count. I've lost count. Quite a few, let's say.
Yeah. Okay, that's awesome. Yeah, I wanted to make sure I touched on that because I definitely am going to be digging into more of that roller derby. That's awesome. So you do most of what you talk about on LinkedIn, and I've gone down some rabbit holes on your YouTube channel, which I didn't know about, which is really amazing and impressive. I want to talk about that a bit later. But you talk a lot about confidence coaching, and I must admit I didn't really know that was a thing. So can you tell me a bit about, like, when somebody asks you what you do for a living, what do you say?
In a nutshell, I basically work with leaders to help them become more confident and either assertive or communicatively confident, should we say. So a lot of the things that comes into leadership comes about how you hold yourself and who you are, not just all the things that people focus on, which is the SWOT analysis and KPIs and, you know, revenue and ROI and all that good stuff. Like, I'm not saying that doesn't have a place in leadership, but if you've got the wrong person with the wrong traits or the wrong confidence or the wrong values in place, everything will have an impact on who they are. So it's not just about what they do, it's how they show up in that day. And that's the part that I'm most interested in.
I got to believe that when people reach out to you, they're not necessarily saying, I have a problem with confidence. They're probably reaching out to you about other issues that once you dig into it, turns out, oh, it comes down to confidence or boundaries or self-respect and the other things you talk about. Is that right?
I think it's a bit of both, in all honesty. I do get people coming to me saying, like, they have imposter syndrome, which is classic self-doubt in the workplace, right? So that doesn't mean that they walk around in every area of their life feeling that they've got a lack of confidence, but they do notice it in particular situations, maybe when they're at work or maybe when they're under pressure or something like that. And then there's other people that they don't have any trouble with confidence until they're faced with something much more pressing, say a senior leadership meeting or giving really bad news to their team or dealing with somebody narcissistic in the office or dealing with a toxic office member or something. Like, those types of things can knock people into a place of, like, I don't quite know what the coping mechanism to deal with this is and how I should deal with it. That's going to be helpful for me and for them. And other people, there are some people that do recognize that they do lack a bit of confidence and they live in a constant place of wanting to do more, wanting to go further, but they're not able to because they're holding themselves back, but they don't know why. So there's a real mix of people. I mean, regardless, I'm dealing with a C-suite person or somebody that's an aspiring manager, the symptoms of what they experience are generally the same, but the circumstances in which they show up for that individual often differs from one person to the next.
What are some of those symptoms?
Symptoms. So somebody might find themselves in a meeting and they keep themselves mute because they think they're worried about saying the wrong thing. Other people, they're faced with conflict and then they back out of it and they kick themselves and they walk away because they didn't say the thing that they wanted to. Maybe they've got a micromanaging boss and they're able to deal with everybody else in the office, but they just don't know how to deal with that person. Sometimes somebody will speak to them or maybe cross the line in terms of the boundary. And then they don't quite know how to deal with it in a way that is going to keep the peace and also respect themselves at the same time. So there's so many different things. Generally, you'll notice that you've got something and a confidence level with how you feel. So you'd be irritated about somebody speaking to you in a way, treating you in a particular way. When you start feeling that resistance and something's wrong, that's your killer sign to there's a little area that you can plug here regarding high level of confidence, which we generally all have, to be clear. It's not just the people I work with.
Well, there's a lot about that I want to come back to, because if you asked me if I suffer from lack of confidence, I think I would say generally no. But when you describe those symptoms, that has been me many times in my life. And I'd like to think, you know, I always look back and say, oh yeah, I used to be like that, but I'm not like that anymore. And yet I bet that if those same situations arose today, I'd probably react the same way. So the story I tell myself is that I'm confident and that I don't suffer from those things anymore. when you describe those things, I'm like, yeah, that does sound really familiar.
I think that's a good point, actually. A lot of people do tend to assume that they don't have confidence issues. So it's a perfect example is myself. So when I first got into coaching, I hired this guy who happened to be a confidence coach. And like you, I'd never heard of it before. The only coaching I'd ever heard of was like a football coach or a badminton coach or a table tennis coach or something. Mm-hmm. Like, what the hell is a confidence coach? And it struck me because at the time, everything that I was doing was symbolic of what people would normally associate with high confidence. So I was captain of my football team. I was a singer going out on, getting up on stage, playing my guitar and singing. And there was a whole bunch of other things that you would assume because of what I was doing that there was no issue with confidence. But that doesn't mean the person feels good about themselves and who they are on a deeper level. And I'm sure, you know, Robin Williams, if he was here, God love him, he would agree with that. So I think too many people entangle the two. They assume that if you're good at doing something, therefore you must have high confidence. And I historically know that isn't how it works. But even I didn't realize that when I got into coaching. I was like, well, I'm good at doing all these things. I'm captain of this and I'm doing that and I'm achieving this and I'm achieving that. How can I not have confidence? But when I looked at my boundaries and I looked at the relationships I was in and the way that I was allowing people to treat me, the way that I wasn't holding, I wasn't speaking up for myself as much as I wanted, the way that I'd only go for things that I knew that I would succeed in. So if I thought I wasn't going to do it, I wouldn't take a risk on it. If I knew I could achieve it, I would go and do it. But people only saw the things that I took action on and saw me succeeding and therefore made the wrong conclusions. So that's something that was a massive eye-opener for me, that although I was very confident in what seemed to be confident-based activities, on a deeper level, I was being pushed around like you wouldn't believe. I was in terrible relationships where I didn't have the strength to stand up for myself more than I did. I was very appeasing to people around me to avoid the conflict. I did everything that people wanted me to do just in case it caused the conflict. So the two don't always go together. They can have an interconnection, obviously, but just because you're good at doing something, if you're a professional footballer or a professional whatever, doesn't mean you go to bed and look in the mirror and think, I'm awesome.
That's interesting. It can be self-fulfilling because you only select things that you think you can succeed in. And maybe because of your fear of failure, you put a lot of work into that to make sure that it goes well. And all that anybody ever sees are the things that you do well, as opposed to the people that have less fear of failure and you know are willing to go out and try a bunch of things and they suck at some things and they fall down. But there actually stems from the confidence to try and do those things. That's interesting.
And even that's what you just mentioned there, is like they're the things that other people see, but it also reinforces their own belief because it's the only thing that they see as well, because they then easily get sidetracked into their own level of confidence because everything that they put their mind to, they achieve. But that doesn't mean that that mega confident underneath, because there could be plenty of things that they want to do, but they're choosing not to do. So they actually reinforce their own belief and it reinforces other people's beliefs. So this little part of them gets lost.
What were you going to that coach for? It occurs to me that probably we all need coaching at some point in our life, but I'm curious your experience. What was going on in your life that made you finally realize you needed coaching? And maybe you didn't realize it was confidence coaching, but you just needed something.
Well, I actually found my coach off an article on Google. It was on page one. And I remember the bit that got me, and I say this to him all the time, is at the very bottom of his article that he wrote, it said something like, if you have any feedback or any questions on this, don't hesitate to drop me an email. All emails will be read, but not all will be replied to. And I thought, I've just got to reach out to this guy just to tell him that this article, it could have been written about me. And I was just so dumbstruck by it. So I just messaged him, never thinking that I was going to get a reply, thinking he was some famous author on page one of Google, but that I did get a reply. Then we bounced emails back and forth. We jumped on a Zoom call and the rest is history, really. But at that time, one thing I remember is it's very much kind of similar to what we just mentioned. I'd gone through, and I'm not secret about this, it's all over my website, but I'd kind of come out of like the tail end of uni, just realizing that even though I had this plethora of understanding, because I've always had my head buried in a psychology book and I've always been fascinated by human behavior and the way people think and the way they communicate and hold themselves, I had this plethora of understanding, but I was still reacting horribly in these different situations and I was just absolutely sick of it. And it was really hard for me to explain to people, because on paper I had such a so-called successful life. Everything around me seemed so stable and happy. And it was. I'm not trying to say that I was some miserable twat or anything. What I'm saying is that, simply put, like, there was a part of me that I just knew wasn't right. I was very sensitive to what people thought of me. I knew that I was people-pleasing a lot and tiptoeing around people. So I was avoiding this conflict. And that was the part that was like, I can't live like this forever. Like, something has to give. So I was doing some research online to work out, why do I react like this? Why do I feel like that? And that's when I found this article from this coach, who I'm now still working with intermittently now, like 12 years later or something. But he was the guy that helped me plug the gaps of the missing pieces. So I'd stopped reacting horribly. I stopped feeling low on myself. I stopped feeling easily wobbled or frustrated at things, or easily not even oversensitive, but just very, very insecure around what people thought about me. And then having spent that time having coaching of him, just completely flip-flopped everything and spun it on its head in terms of my belief around the power of coaching. Because as much as I say therapy has its place, I honestly believe that I got more benefit out of that 4 to 6 months that I've worked with him than I did in the 12 years that I'd had the therapy. So it's like, well, if I've got a good head for this type of stuff, and I've now seen the personal impact of how powerful it can be, I can help other people with this as well. 3 years later, I was like, I want to do this myself. So walked out of my corporate job and set my own business up, and here I am now.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. It's amazing. I've got to believe that you hear that from clients all the time when you write something on LinkedIn or you put something on YouTube about how they feel like you are speaking right to them. Mm. You share a lot of personal and vulnerable stories, and even the one, I went down some rabbit holes on YouTube, and you were talking, I think, about boundaries. And I was like, oh shit, I think it was written just for me.
So what part about boundaries did you find most unusual, or something you hadn't heard before?
In one of the videos, you were talking about the things that irritate us, just as an example, the things that irritate us about our partner or our friends, and that we've sort of lived with forever, and that after 20 or 30 years, they continue to irritate us. And yet we still get frustrated and pissed off at people, but we've never told them that it bothers us. And they have no idea. I'd love to ask about how people get started on this, because it's pretty scary. Like, I've got good friendships and good relationships. Like, that seems like a really vulnerable, scary conversation to have with somebody. It's not somebody I met with a week ago, you know, I met a week ago and say, hey, I just wanted to let you know, here are some things I've noticed and I want to set some boundaries. It's like, how do you have that conversation with somebody you've known your whole life?
It's a question I get quite a lot. I mean, you can go into a conversation like that. I think what tends to happen is what happened with me anyway. You start off small because it's such a big area, and it's so hard to change everything at once. And you're coming generally from a place of lower confidence, because if you haven't been holding boundaries for a long time, it reinforces this dent of your confidence. You've got this little ball of confidence. And every time you don't respect yourself or you lower one of your boundaries, it takes a little tiny chip out of it. Now, what I always often say to my clients, if that happens once in your life, it's not going to really do any damage. It's almost on akin to your diet. You have one McDonald's, you don't become unhealthy. But if you live on McDonald's, you're not going to be healthy. And it's the same with lowering your boundaries. If every time you're faced with a time when you've got to be firm on your boundaries and you don't, the impact on you is that you're basically saying, I'm not worth standing up for. My boundaries don't matter. What other people think is more important than what I think. So when you constantly keep repeating that pattern to yourself, from behaviors rather than what we say. So often we say, don't do that. And then somebody does it and we allow them to do it. So that's just as good as saying, yeah, please do it. It's just as good as saying to yourself, it doesn't matter what I say and what I do, other people are more important. Generally, I start with the values, like what is important to you? What is it that makes you tick? Because not everybody is as precious about some topics as other people are. We're all quite unique. So once we understand what our boundaries actually are and what is important to us, we can start then seeing the gaps as like, but I'm not holding a boundary there. And I'm not holding a boundary there. And hold on a minute. I've been taking that shit for 10 years of my mate. That's going to have to stop. Wait, I've been allowing that to happen for 20 years of that friend. Wait, my boyfriend, I've always done that. So that's not going to happen again. And then you start realizing, so that's the bit that I need to hold. And every time we do that, it's a little extra layer of confidence that we're adding to ourselves, because we're basically saying it does matter, it is important, and our needs and boundaries do matter. So it isn't an easy conversation to have, but it's not unusual regarding friendships that you mentioned before, when you've had a friendship for years. In my experience, it's actually helped filter out the ones that really matter to the ones that were more kind of on the fence, or maybe just more like an acquaintance. A lot of people show up in your life when there's not really much happening, but the moment like shit hits the fan, that's when you really see who your true friends are, and also the ones that cheerlead you on whilst you're doing well as well. It's not just the ones that come to your rescue and become the savior when things go badly. And obviously you have to offer that back in return to your friends. So it's this mutual chain of energy between the two. It's not just a one-way thing. But as my confidence grew and my boundaries grew, I did start realizing there were people in my life that I wasn't holding boundaries in a way that would basically be self-respecting to me. So you do start having to have those conversations. And the way that I approached it, to answer your question, is to simply say, I'm going through some changes at the moment. I'm going through a lot of self-development. I'm working with a coach. If you need to say that, add that in if you need to. But these are the changes I'm making. These are the things I've identified. And this is how I plan on changing it. Now, I've had situations where the boundary that I've put in place between a long-standing friend that I've just noticed something that I'm not willing to put up with anymore, I will communicate that thing. Now, this is where you really get into what type of long-term friendship you might have, because that person's either going to respond in a way of, yeah, okay, that's fair, because what you're saying is fair and I'm fair and I want to maintain a relationship on mutual ground. Or, no, I don't like these terms because it isn't giving me the thing that I want, and you holding boundaries now an inconvenience to me. So often those people do start fizzling out of your life, but then new people come in, and the ones that you connect with are more akin to who the new version of you is. So the friendships that you now create when you're turning into a better person become stronger, they become more connected, they become safer. So you're not even faced with these dilemmas in the same way when you have a different friendship group as you would have been when you're dealing with a previous friendship group that maybe didn't respect those boundaries.
Yeah, wow, that resonates with me a lot. Almost 3 years or so ago, I quit drinking. And the thing that I was really nervous about, among other things, was, am I going to realize that all my friends were just drinking buddies? I mean, of course, it's not like we got together and got hammered every single time we got together, but alcohol was pretty much a part of everything we did together. And we could go biking and do healthy things, but at the end of it, it was time to have some drinks, right? And what I found is that I haven't been as purposeful as what you're describing. And I think there'd be a lot of value in me doing that, but it's kind of happened like organically where some stress, but you're right. Some relationships have gotten much stronger and deeper because we actually have time to talk about other things other than how awesome the last 5 minutes were. Yeah. And some have sort of just filtered away, but I should be more purposeful about it. Just could we step back a little bit? Because this idea of boundaries that occurs to me, maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but I had never heard of something called boundaries until maybe a year or so ago, or maybe since COVID, I don't know. And now it seems to be all everybody's talking about. So can you talk to me a little bit about what you mean by boundaries, like some examples maybe from your own life or things that you've seen people struggle with?
Wow, that's such a big question. Not even quite know where to start. So let me just add some context to boundaries and what they are first. They're basically the rules in which you want to, what you accept or don't accept. A lot of people might think it's trying to control the other person. It's not. It's basically communicating with the other person. This is what I'll accept and this is what I won't accept. I'll give you a really obvious example that many might relate to. I'm going back, I don't know, but a decade, maybe even more, who knows. It was a long time ago, but I had a couple of dates with a guy and it came out that he liked to dabble in recreational drugs like coke or whatever. Fine, like, you know, if people want to do that. But I wasn't particularly looking for that type of relationship at all. So I communicated that with him, and his response was, "Well, you're trying to tell me what I can and can't do." I said, "This isn't me telling what you can and can't do, but I'm telling you what I'm willing to accept in this relationship for me. So as a result, if that's something you want to do, that's fine. I'm not here to judge you, but then you need to go and do it. But I'm going to choose to opt out of that. But if you want to have a relationship with me, that isn't something I'm looking for. So that isn't something that I'm going to tolerate in this relationship." So it isn't me telling, basically what he was saying is, "I want to be with you, but I want to do things my way." And I'm saying, "Well, it isn't about your way or my way. It's actually, this is the thing that I'm willing to accept or not to start off this relationship." It's the same, you could argue it's the same about cheating, right? Some people might say, "Look, if you're with me, you're with me. If you're not with me, you go and do your own thing. But if you're with me, don't cheat on me." So if people then say that, they're not saying you can't cheat, like they are kind of saying you can't cheat, but if they want to cheat on other people, that's up to them. But if you're with me, these are the terms that I work by for my own self-respect. It's not about me trying to dictate what you do. It's me showing you where my boundaries lie in terms of my own self-respect and what I will or not will not accept. So once people get their head around that bit, because so many people seem to think they're going to be dominating or controlling or belittling other people if they start saying you can and can't do this, it's not a communication of you can or can't do this. It's a communication of this is what I will and will not accept. And that comes down to the way that you're spoken to, the way people treat you, the jokes that people make about you. Sometimes you find them funny, sometimes you won't. Everybody has different rules for different things. Some people lend money and they religiously want it back. Other people lend money knowing that they're never going to get it back. But whatever that individual's boundary is, then becomes a thing that they have to honor based on how much they care about it. So once you become clear of your own boundaries, you can start applying them based on whatever relationship you have with some people, because it isn't a one-stop shop for everybody. And the example I often give for this is that if you're in the pub and you're there with your partner and your partner walks past you on the way to the loo and they grab your bum, the chances are that's not going to be a problem. It's kind of like not a bad thing at all. Whereas if a stranger walks past and does exactly the same thing, they might get a swift slap around the face. So it's the same behavior, but it has a different rule book based on the relationship you have with that individual. So it's, for me, boundaries is not necessarily just about the rule book of what you can and can't do. It's, you know, what's the level of closeness you have with that person to judge if that person is okay within that boundary level and not. So again, with friends, I've got some friends I'll tell everything to, like they know literally everything about me. But then I've got an extra layer of friends that I'm close to. I'm not quite as close to, so I don't let them in on my inner darker secrets. And then I've got a layer of acquaintance after that. I generally talk about weather and Christmas holidays and all the basic stuff. And then there's a level after that, which will be people that more like people I've never met. And they're the people I'm willing to be vulnerable with on things like social media. But I do it on my terms, the stuff that I'm choosing to share, not just this is my diary, everybody. So it does fluctuate based on the boundary, based on the relationship that you have with that individual.
It's interesting. You went earlier when you said you started with kind of the values. Like, I'm curious if people suspect that they might want to dig into this, like me, like, how do you get started? How do you try to figure out, okay, I could write down some of my friends and my wife, maybe even my kids. How do I figure out what those boundaries might be for different people?
Sure. So when I talk about values, I talk about who the person is, not just what they want to do or what they want to achieve. So when people say things like money is a value, I personally disagree with that. So if I said to somebody, all right, if I gave you 10 million quid, but the rule was that you couldn't leave your house ever again, very few people say, yes, I would accept that. And the reason for that is because what they want to do with the money. So it's a medium to get there. So money becomes the vehicle as opposed to the actual value. Whatever it is that you want to do with it is normally more closely connected to the value. So when you actually start digging down to who you are, we're talking about the likes of honesty, bravery, integrity, curiosity, acceptance, you know, all these good things that once you adopt as a human being, by default, you become a better leader. By default, you become a better parent. By default, you become a better friend. But when you start analyzing what those particular values look like, not just honesty is a nice little flippant word. Like, what does it mean to truly be honest? You know, is it honest when you just say to somebody, you're fat? Because I don't think that's honest. I think that's just pure judgment. So, you know, like, and then you have to combine it with things like kindness. Communicating with honesty isn't just walking around in an unfiltered, harmful way. It's about communicating the thing that is most important to you to be communicated, but communicating it from who you are in that moment and what you're feeling and experiencing as opposed to what this other person is doing. So the impact on you, that's the most honest thing that you can ever share. So once you have an understanding of all the different, all the different values that you have, it becomes very clear to you who you are. Because the key thing that I always say to my clients is when it comes to values, it's not just about, most people think of values, but what they offer other people. Mm. It's how am I kind to other people? How am I honest with other people? How am I curious to other people? Actually, first and foremost is what you offer yourself. It's very hard to be kind to other people when you're not kind to yourself. It's very hard to be patient with other people when you're not patient with yourself. So you show up as who you want to be first and foremost, then you can offer them to other people because you become a more solid person. You can be a better friend. You can be a better partner. But it's very easy to identify where you're compromising your boundaries once you've got a really solid handle on what your values are and how that, what that means for who you are.
Yeah, it seems to me too, when I'm reflecting on what you're saying, Angie, maybe there's an element of accountability, because I think I've done some work periodically around values, and yes, those things around empathy and honesty and creativity and courage come into play. I think what I'm hearing you say is that maybe some of this work helps us confront the difference between who we say we want to be and who we actually are.
That's exactly it. So you get a very good idea. There's an exercise I created that I run through with my clients where we go through what their values are. We have a long list of like probably 15 values. We shortlist them into the top between 3 and 5. But with the exercise that I go through, it highlights on every single point if they're compromising on themselves or if they're not compromising on themselves, and if they're favoritizing the other person or if they're not favoritizing the other person. And then at the end of it, you've got a level, like a score out of, say, roughly 15 for how you're offering the values to yourself and how you're offering them to others. And it's very usual at the end of this particular exercise to see how people get 3 out of 15 or 4 out of 15. Then you can identify the gaps. These are all the values that they've just said that are important to them. And now the understanding of real context of what each value means. And then we go through a situation that they were faced with, conflict or a difficult situation where they had to make a quick decision or they weren't able to please everybody in whatever decision that they made. And then as how they handle it is indicative of that value and how it shows up in that scenario. And if every time they're faced with something difficult, they compromise on themselves, that means they're always going to play safe because they know that when they're faced with something difficult, they're going to be compromising, right? And that exercise highlights people normally get 3 or 4 out of, say, 15 for themselves. And often they get probably 7 or 8, maybe even 9 out of 15 for the other person. So there's room for improvement on both, but 99% of the time it's most improvement for themselves. And that's when you can start identifying who you are versus who you want to be and start plugging those gaps.
It sounds enlightening and terrifying at the same time.
Hopefully not too terrifying.
Not too terrifying. Yeah, that's amazing. One of the things that you mentioned that really stuck with me when we were chatting earlier, Angie, is that you said you love leaning into conversations that other people avoid. And what I loved about that is that it does tie back to kind of really what the origin story of this podcast, kind of having awkward conversations where we're outside our comfort zone and we're vulnerable, et cetera. But I'm curious what that means to you and some examples of conversations that you lead into that, because I imagine other people, their reaction is like, you what? You talk to who about what?
Yeah, exactly. Very true. And I don't think I've got a particular rule book of who I have those conversations with. It's not like everybody has a yes or no next to the name and, you know, the phone book or something. But I do like those conversations, one, because I like being different and I like breaking the stigma of what we can and can't talk about safely. Two, they're typically conversations that everybody's interested in and everybody wants to listen to, but they just don't have the guts to launch into it. Three, mm-hmm. They're often very, very embarrassing and so intimate that people start cringing and going, oh my God, I can't believe she's saying it. They listen to me talk at the end of it, go, yeah, she had a bloody good point there, didn't she? So there's that kind of thing. And I just don't think that we should carry so much shame around things that we all talk and feel about, you know, things like intimacy. I talk about that occasionally on LinkedIn, but not obviously my own, because that's way too private, but you know, why relationships like fall apart and why intimacy falls out the window in relationship and what the psychology of what's really going on. It's not really about the intimacy. It's the psychology behind the lack of connection that is then driving the outcome of like that lost part of their relationship. There's other parts when we talk about things that people normally carry shame around. So bad decisions that they've made or horrible relationships that they've been in. I made a post today. There's a And again, I'm not secret about it, but who I used to be from probably the age of, well, when I started having a bit of a personality, and don't mean like baby, but, you know, when I started getting boyfriends and stuff like that, my first proper boyfriend was at 14, which I was with for just over 3 years. And then I went from that relationship to another one, to another, right up until my probably late 20s to my early 30s, just bouncing from one abusive relationship to another. And it's not a sob story. It's not a badge of honor. It just is the facts. That's what I ended up doing. But when I look back at that, on paper, again, I look very, very confident, but everything was just a reflection of who I saw myself as, how I viewed myself, how much I respected myself, how much I, you know, was willing to tolerate this bullshit from terrible treatment from people that I was choosing. And I have to take some of that accountability as well. I could sit here all day and play the woe is me, all these bad guys out there. I don't believe that for a second. I think the world is full of good human beings, male and female. But if you have low self-worth, you will attract people who are going to treat you in alignment to how you view yourself. If you have high self-worth, it's exactly the same principle, which is why I think getting the self-worth is so important. So I talk about the fact that one of my exes used to put cigarettes out on my arm. I talk about the fact that I had an alarm clock thrown at my head. I talk about the fact that I've been in very narcissistic relationships where it's highly abusive and you get gaslit all the time. Like somebody, it's that classic, somebody does something to be really quite harmful. You try and put up a boundary about it and then you gaslit in this, I can't believe you're being that sensitive. Oh my God, what's wrong with you? You used to be so much fun. You've changed. And all this like shaming connotations that are attached to their words. So, and you don't want to tell other people, you've become codependent with this person. You're embarrassed by the treatment that you're taking, but you also don't feel, if you're unconfident, it's very scary to leave that person because a lot of your life is entangled with them. You doubt yourself, you doubt your own values, you doubt your own worth. So you stick around and you take it, but you don't tell anyone because it's bloody embarrassing that you're taking this shit from somebody. But normally what happens is somebody just gets to breaking point and they're like, I have to get out, and they leave. They'll often spend some time on their own, feel like they've recovered, they've generally built the confidence, but if they haven't started doing things differently to build the self-worth, they will just repeat the pattern with the next person. But once you've got that, that the self-worth bit nailed, it changes everything. It changes the jobs you apply for. It changes how much money you believe that you're worthy of making. It changes the types of conversations that you have. It changes the relationships you're in. It changes your friendships. It changes how you view yourself. Everything changes. Like when you get to that self-worth bit, it's not just about doing things well. It's about being a good person and feeling like a good person and not tolerating anything less.
Yeah. And there was a lot of stuff on your YouTube channel. It was really interesting. You had a conversation with a guy named Bill Ranshaw, and he's a recovering porn addict and is now a porn recovery coach. And you guys talked about
everything.
Like, yeah, everything. I was listening to him talk and I'm watching, because it's a great thing about video, I'm watching your face and you didn't react. You were like, okay, this is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things even Bill came out with that shocked me. I was like, wow, in the sense of I'd never heard it before of somebody speaking that way before, but I wasn't expecting him to say it in that particular podcast. So I know exactly the one you're talking about, but that's a good example of, I mean, Bill got a few clients via me from that. So a few people that have been following me on whatever the social media channel is reached out to me to get in touch with him. But one thing I did say to Bill, I remember clearly at the end of the interview, is although we got into some graphics and, you know, he's quite explicit on some of the things he said, but on a deeper level, everybody was using something to mask the pain that they're actually feeling. And really on a deeper level, what it came down to is that all these people secretly were seeking and wanting deeper connection, but because they weren't having it, they were leaning into other things as a substitute, whether it was work, whether it was, you know, alcohol, whether it was taking drugs, whether it was porn. And our clients are actually quite similar from a psychosomatic perspective, but the outlet of how they're dealing with it and what their coping mechanisms were actually quite different.
Yeah, I did love that conversation. I also came across, it was amazing. What my favorite, I think, YouTube video would have been, I think I wrote it down here somewhere. What was it called? It was called, how much time do you dedicate to the things you're passionate about? I'm like, oh, that sounds interesting. And it was simply you playing Wanted Dead or Alive by Bon Jovi in your van on your guitar. I was like, oh, that's amazing. You kind of tricked me into watching it. You were really good and you're a great voice and did a great job, because that's not an easy song to play. But I was like, oh, isn't that cool? Like, yeah, just a mishmash of really interesting, powerful stuff on there.
Thanks, man. It's just, I don't want to be seen as just the coach. People then just know me as the girl that does a bit of psychology, the confidence girl, the girl who bangs on about boundaries all the time. When actually, I'm a lot more than just a coach. Like, I've got interests, I've got life outside of coaching, I've got friends that I spend time with, I like going ramp skating, I like playing roller derby, I like to play my guitar, I like to sing. So, you know, I like to think there's a little bit more to me. And I think it's important when you are on social media to show that side to who you are. Like, you've done it yourself. I've seen pictures of you on your bike in front of big, you know, lakes and things, which shows that you're off on a bike ride. It shows health and fitness. I think it's so important to expose that side to our personalities and not just be, this is just the one thing that I do for work.
Yeah. Yeah, you do a great job of that. One of the things that you talked about on recently, I think this last summer, is, you know, we connected and we were commenting back and forth, kind of hashtag van life. So you had picked up and gone on a trip in your van, I think for like a month or so. And what I loved about that is it seemed like it's a bit of a fantasy. Like, so many of us have just dreamed of picking up and taking off and just traveling the countryside. And I'd love to learn more about that. Like, what did you learn from a month just living in your van?
So, wow. I've gone away before for a similar kind of time in a van. I've had a van for 10 years now. So I've upgraded slightly in the last couple of years. Yeah. There's just something about the freedom of just going and being in a field. As it happened, I landed a heat wave on that month as well. So as great as it was for me, it was not good for my old dog, who was on little did I know, he was weeks away from dying at that moment as well. So, but what do I learn from it? Just the fact that we don't need to just do the life that we normally lead. So that freedom just to pick up and go is, I don't even quite know how to explain it, but for me, it's what I'm here for. I mean, I make this podcast from Portugal. This isn't my kitchen behind me. And again, I've just got tired of being in somewhere that was cold and miserable and nothing really happening, to just thinking, right, well, I'll just go and I can do, as long as I've got my laptop and I've got Wi-Fi, I can go anywhere. So in terms of the van, it's great. You get to see people around the country. You get to see parts of your own country that you would never normally see. You normally have to deal with some adventure. You have to manage life a bit differently because you're juggling between working with a little tiny camping stove coupled with a place that you don't know where you are, and then your awning nearly taking off in a storm or whatever. And there's loads to contend with. I do have a lot of plans to travel next year as well, around Europe potentially, or even just up in sticks and shooting off to somewhere in the Caribbean for 3 months. I don't know. Now I've got a lot more flexibility than ever. Lost my dog. Don't have children, currently single. I can do what I want to do, go where I want to go. And it's not something I ever take for granted. It's not, a lot of people say, oh, I'd love to be able to do that. But I don't sit there thinking, oh, I'll just do it then. Because I know that I'm privileged in the sense that I don't have the many ties that other people have. You know, I've got the freedom to be a bit of a digital nomad without the ties that most people, you know, that they have that keep them in one place.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I was so sorry to hear about Louis. I think you had posted something about that and it just broke my heart, you know, the vision of you having this companion with you in your van and then losing him shortly after getting back. I think it sounds like he had a pretty good life for the last little bit of it anyway, on the road with you.
Yeah, I like to think so. I mean, our last, that month, it was August that I went traveling, 2024. And that particular month was literally his last full month of living. Yeah. So after we got back, we'd only been back about 4 days, maybe 3 days, and he got sick. And I was like, this is not his usual self. I knew it was bad. And then he got progressively worse. And then I called it on it was the 5th of September to be exact. It was a Thursday. But it's, little did I know all the way through that adventure is that every day was our last full month together, which meant that he slept in the van with me playing Little Spoon while we slept every night to build it up. And he normally wanted to sleep in my bed back at home, and I would never let him because it's a bit minging. So he had the luxury of the van, and he had the last month together where we just spooned every night. God love him. So yeah, but I don't think I'll be in a rush to get a new dog just yet. I'm looking for a bit more freedom for now.
That's amazing. I love that. So yeah, we've covered a lot of things, Angie. This has been amazing. What are you excited about next? What's next for you?
So I think the thing that is really playing on my mind a lot at the moment is wanting to change my business up a little bit. So there's a number of things I've got in store for 2025. But one thing I want to give more dedication to and attention to is getting more speaking gigs, whether it be podcasts like this, whether it be on stage. I've got one coming up at the end of this month that's got, I don't know, 100 people in, this big screen behind me. I want more of those types of events because I feel that I come more alive when I'm in real human to human contact. I spend all my day, most days, looking through a screen like this, talking to people that are lovely like this. But that's not what I was put on this earth to do. Like, I can help people. I like talking. I like using my voice to help heal people, but I can have a bigger impact if I work with a group. Being in a room with people when you can feel the energy, you know that you're having a different type of impact is something that I really want to get into a lot next year. So that's going to be something that I think is going to take a precedence as my new focus over like getting loads of one-to-one clients or something like that. I'd rather build a bit of a clientele list in terms of public speaking and podcasts and interviews.
Yeah. Do you do speaking in North America or is it primarily in Europe?
The only time I've left the UK, I went to Amsterdam a couple of years ago for an event where I was kind of mediating out there. But on the whole, it's all UK. But I'm absolutely flexible. I mean, I'm just waiting for the invite. But I'm just waiting. If somebody contacted me and said, come and talk in America, absolutely. I've got nothing stopping me from going. It's not even about really me doing the speaking that I'm driven by. It's the thought of being able to help a lot of people that are going to be in those audiences, which is a higher level than just hoping that if you put something out on social media and hoping people interpret it correctly. I think it just is a lot more impactful when it does this. And I already do speaking gigs all the time. So I do imposter syndrome, resilience, confidence, boundaries, all that fun stuff. But I want to get more into like the speaking arena and talk about lots of other things as well.
Yeah, I can imagine there's not only those topics that you just talked about just resonate. I don't know anybody that doesn't suffer from some or all of those things from time to time. Yeah. But also I do still think that there's this hunger for getting people together in one place. Like I can speak for myself. It's so tempting. It's so easy. I could make a good living and never really have to leave my attic. But man, when I get out and talk to people and find myself in a room full of people, and I imagine when you're in, on stage in front of people, like that energy is just something you cannot get from Portugal or at least wherever you are in the world staring into a camera.
Yeah, for sure. And it's the same with music, right? So nobody would, a band, if they were like a big band, whatever, and they're doing a gig at Wembley and they've got all those people there watching them, there's no way you'd get the same performance out of them if they're in the bedroom playing together and it was just being done through Zoom and all those people were just watching it through a screen. You just cannot replicate that connection and that energy when you're in a room with people like in real life. So I want to be doing a lot more of that next year because it's just so much more rewarding than spending every day in your office looking into a screen, like you just said. So I'm not driven by the money. I'm driven by the experience, basically.
Angie, this conversation has delivered on everything I was hoping for. It was well worth the wait. You've given me so many things to reflect on around the confidence and the boundaries piece, and it's just an inspiring stories. I know it's going to stick with me for a long time. We're going to include in the show notes your website and your YouTube channel and all the amazing places that people can go and connect with you. So I can't thank you enough for being here. This has been awesome.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It's been fun.
Thanks, Angie.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.